levels of poetry. Now, don't misunderstand me willfully, Tom said firmly. Philip didn't say that Jack is ignorant, quite the opposite. He's saying that Jack is so clever he should have more education. Jack was not pleased by these compliments. He shared his mother's suspicion of churchmen. There was sure to be a catch in this somewhere. More, Ellen said scornfully. What more does that monk want him to learn? I'll tell you. Theology, Latin, rhetoric, metaphysics. Cow shit! Don't dismiss it so quickly, Tom said mildly. If Jack takes up Philip's offer and goes to school and learns to write at speed in a good secretary's hand, and studies Latin and theology and all the other subjects you call cowshit, he could become a clerk to an earl or a bishop, and eventually he could be a wealthy and powerful man. Not all barons are the sons of barons, as the saying goes. Ellen's eyes narrowed dangerously. If he takes up Philip's offer, you said. What is Philip's offer, exactly? That Jack becomes a novice monk. Over my dead body! Ellen shouted, leaping to her feet. The damn church is not having my son. Those treacherous lying priests took his father, but they're not taking him. I'll put a knife in Philip's belly first. So help me, I swear by all the gods. Tom had seen Mother in a tantrum before, and he was not as impressed as he might have been. He said calmly, What the devil is the matter with you, woman? The boy has been offered a magnificent opportunity. Jack was intrigued most of all by the words, Those treacherous lying priests took his father. What did she mean by that? He wanted to ask her, but he did not get the chance. He's not going to be a monk, she yelled. If he doesn't want to be a monk, he doesn't have to. Mother looked sulky. That sly prior has a knack of getting his own way in the end, she said. Tom turned to Jack. It's about time you said something, lad. What do you want to do with your life? Jack had never thought about that particular question, but the answer came out with no hesitation, as if he had made up his mind long ago. I'm going to be a master builder like you, he said. I'm going to build the most beautiful cathedral the world has ever seen. The red edge of the sun dropped below the horizon and night fell. It was time for the last ritual of Midsummer Eve. Floating wishes. Jack had a candle end and a piece of wood ready. He looked at Ellen and Tom. They were both gazing at him, somewhat nonplussed. His certainty about his future had surprised them. Well, no wonder. It had surprised him, too. Seeing that they had no more to say, he jumped to his feet and ran across the meadow to the bonfire. He lit a dry twig at the fire, melted the base of his candle a little, and stuck it to the piece of wood. Then he lit the wick. Most of the villagers were doing the same. Those who could not afford a candle made a sort of boat with dried grass and rushes, and twisted the grasses together in the middle to make a wick. Jack saw Aliena standing quite near him. Her face was outlined by the red glow of the bonfire, and she looked deep in thought. On impulse, he said, What will you wish for, Aliena? She answered him without pausing for thought. Peace, she said. Then, looking somewhat startled, she turned away. Jack wondered if he were crazy to love her. She liked him well enough, they had become friends. But the idea of lying naked together and kissing one another's hot skin was as far from her heart as it was close to his own. When everyone was ready, they knelt down beside the river, or waded into the shallows. Holding their flickering lights, they all made a wish. Jack closed his eyes tight and visualized Aliena, lying in a bed with her breasts peeping over the coverlet, holding her arms out to him and saying, Make love to me, husband. Then they all carefully floated their lights on the water. If the float sank, or the flame blew out, it meant you would never get your wish. As soon as Jack let go and the little craft moved away, the wooden base became invisible, and only the flame could be seen. He watched it intently for a while, then he lost track of it among the hundreds of dancing lights bobbing on the surface of the water, flickering wishes floating downstream, until they disappeared around the bend of the river and were lost from view. 3. All that summer Jack told Aliena stories. They met on Sundays, occasionally at first and then regularly, in the glade by the little waterfall. He told her about Charlemagne and his knights, and William of Orange and the Saracens. He became completely absorbed in the stories while he was telling them. Aliena liked to watch the expressions change on his young face. He was indignant about injustice, appalled by treachery, thrilled by the bravery of a knight, and moved to tears by a heroic death. And his emotions were catching so that she too was moved. Some of the poems were too long to recite in one afternoon, and when he had to tell a story in installments, he always broke off at a moment of tension, so that Aliena spent all week wondering what would happen next. She never told anyone about these meetings. She was not sure why. Perhaps it was that they would not understand the fascination of stories. Whatever the reason, she just let people believe that she was going on her usual Sunday afternoon ramble, and without consulting her, Jack did the same. Then it got to the point where they could not tell anyone without appearing to confess to something they felt guilty about, and so, rather by accident, the meetings became secret. One Sunday, Aliena read The Romance of Alexander to him, just for a change. Unlike Jack's poems of courtly intrigue, international politics, and sudden death in battle, Aliena's romance featured love affairs and magic. Jack was very taken with these new storytelling elements, and the following Sunday he embarked upon a new romance of his own invention. It was a hot day in late August. Aliena was wearing sandals and a light linen dress. The forest was still and silent but for the tinkling of the waterfall and the rise and fall of Jack's voice. The story began in a conventional way, with a description of a brave knight, big and strong, mighty in battle, and armed with a magic sword, who was assigned a difficult task, to travel to a far eastern land and bring back a grapevine that grew rubies. But it rapidly deviated from the usual pattern. The knight was killed, and the story focused on his squire, a brave but penniless young man of 17 who was hopelessly in love with the king's daughter, a beautiful princess. The squire vowed to fulfill the task given to his master, even though he was young and inexperienced and had only a piebald pony and a bow. Instead of vanquishing an enemy with one tremendous blow of a magic sword, as the hero generally did in these stories, the squire fought desperate losing battles and won only by luck or ingenuity, generally escaping death by a hair. He was often scared by the enemies that he faced, unlike Charlemagne's fearless knights, but he never turned back from his mission. All the same, his task, like his love, seemed hopeless. Aliena found herself more captivated by the pluck of the squire than she had been by the might of his master. She chewed her knuckles in anxiety when he rode into enemy territory, gasped when a giant sword barely missed him, and sighed when he lay down his lonely head to sleep and dream of the faraway princess. His love for her seemed of a piece with his general indomitability. In the end, he brought home the grapevine that grew rubies, astonishing the entire court. But the squire did not care that much, Jack said with a contemptuous snap of his fingers, for all those barons and earls. He was interested in one person only. That night, he stole into her room, evading the guards with a cunning ruse he had learned on his journey east. At last he stood beside her bed and gazed upon her face. Jack looked into Aliena's eyes as he said this. She woke at once, but she was not afraid. The squire reached out and gently took her hand. Jack mimed the story, reaching for Aliena's hand and holding it in both of his. She was mesmerized by the intensity of his gaze and the power of the young squire's love, and she hardly noticed that Jack was holding her hand. He said to her, "I love you dearly," and kissed her on the lips. Jack leaned over and kissed Aliena. His lips touched hers so gently that she hardly felt it. It happened very quickly, and he resumed the story instantly. "The princess fell asleep," he continued. Aliena thought, "Did that really happen? Did Jack kiss me?" She could hardly believe it, but she could still feel the touch of his mouth on hers. The next day, The squire asked the king if he could marry the princess, as his reward for bringing home the jeweled vine. "Jack kissed me without thinking," Aliena decided. "It was just part of the story. He doesn't even realize what he did. I'll just forget about it." The king refused him. The squire was heartbroken. All the courtiers laughed. That very day the squire left that land, riding on his piebald pony. But he vowed that one day he would return, and on that day he would marry the beautiful princess. Jack stopped and let go of Aliena's hand. "And then what happened?" she said. "I don't know," Jack replied. "I haven't thought of it yet." All the important people in Kingsbridge joined the parish guild. It was a new idea to most of them, but they liked the thought that Kingsbridge was now a town, not a village, and their vanity was touched by the appeal to them, as leading citizens, to provide a stone church. Aliena and Alfred recruited the members and organized the first guild dinner in mid-September. The major absentees were Prior Philip, who was somewhat hostile to the enterprise, although not enough to prohibit it, Tom Builder, who declined because of Philip's feeling, and Malachi, who was excluded by his religion. Meanwhile, Ellen had woven a bale of cloth from Aliena's surplus wool. It was coarse and colourless, but it was good enough for monks' robes, and the priory cellarer, Cuthbert Whitehead, had bought it. The price was cheap, but it was still double the cost of the original wool, and even after paying Ellen a penny a day, Aliena was better off by half a pound. Cuthbert was keen to buy more cloth at that price, so Aliena bought Philip's surplus wool to add to her own stock, and found a dozen more people, mostly women, to weave it. Ellen agreed to make another bale, but she would not felt it, for she said the work was too hard, and most of the others said the same. Aliena sympathized. Felting, or fulling, was heavy work. She remembered how she and Richard had gone to a master fuller in Winchester and asked him to employ them. The fuller had had two men pounding cloth with bats in a trough while a woman poured water in. The woman had shown Aliena her raw red hands, and when the men had put a bale of wet cloth on Richard's shoulder it had brought him to his knees. Most people could manage to felt a small amount, enough to make clothes for themselves and their families, but only strong men could do it all day. Aliena told her weavers to go ahead and make loose-woven cloth, and she would hire men to felt it, or sell it to a master fuller in Winchester. The guild dinner was held in the wooden church. Aliena organized the food. She parcelled out the cooking among the members, most of whom had at least one domestic servant. Alfred and his men constructed a long table made of trestles and boards. They bought strong ale and a barrel of wine. They sat at either side of the table, with nobody at the head or foot, for all were to be equal within the guild. Aliena wore a deep red silk dress ornamented by a gold brooch with rubies in it, and a dark grey pelisse with fashionably wide sleeves. The parish priest said grace. He, of course, was delighted by the idea of the guild, for a new church would increase his prestige and multiply his income. Alfred presented a budget and timetable for the building of the new church. He spoke as if this were all his own work, but Aliena knew that Tom had done most of it. The building would take 2 years and cost £90, and Alfred proposed that the guild's 40 members should each pay sixpence a week. It was a little more than some of them had reckoned on, Aliena could tell by their faces. They all agreed to pay it, but Aliena thought the guild could expect one or two to default. She herself could pay it easily. Looking around the table, she realized she was probably the richest person there. She was in a small minority of women. The only others were a Brewster, with a reputation for good strong ale, a tailor who employed two seamstresses and some apprentices, and the widow of a shoemaker who managed the business her husband had left. Aliena was the youngest woman there, and younger than any of the men except Alfred, who was a year or two younger than she. Aliena missed Jack. She had not yet heard the second instalment of the story of the young squire. Today was a holiday, and she would have liked to meet him in the glade. Perhaps she still could, later on. The talk around the table was of the Civil War. Stephen's wife, Queen Matilda, had put up more of a fight than anyone expected. She had recently taken the city of Winchester and captured Robert of Gloucester. Robert was the brother of the Empress Maud and the commander-in-chief of her military forces. Some people said Maud was only a figurehead, and Robert was the true leader of the rebellion. In any event, the capture of Robert was almost as bad for Maud as the capture of Stephen had been for the Loyalists, and everyone had an opinion of what direction the war would take next. The drink at this feast was stronger than that provided by Prior Philip, and as the meal progressed, the revellers became quite raucous. The parish priest failed to act as a restraining influence, probably because he was drinking as much as anyone else. Alfred, who was sitting next to Aliena, seemed preoccupied, but even he became flushed. Aliena herself was not fond of strong drink, and she took a cup of apple cider with her dinner. When most of the food was finished, someone proposed a toast to Alfred and Aliena. Alfred beamed with pleasure as he acknowledged it. After that, the singing began, and Aliena started to wonder how soon she could slip away. Alfred said to her, "We did well together." Aliena smiled. "Let's see how many of them are still paying sixpence a week this time next year." Alfred did not want to hear about misgivings or qualifications today. "We did well," he repeated. "We're a good team." He raised his cap to her and drank. "Don't you think we're a good team?" "We certainly are," she said, to humour him. "I've enjoyed it," he went on, "doing this with you. The guild, I mean." "I've enjoyed it too," she said politely. "Have you? That makes me very happy." She looked at him more carefully. Why was he labouring the point? His speech was clear and precise, and he showed no signs of real drunkenness. "It's been fine," she said neutrally. He put a hand on her shoulder. She hated to be touched, but she had trained herself not to flinch, because men became so offended. "Tell me something," he said, lowering his voice to an intimate level. "What are you looking for in a husband?" "Surely he's not going to ask me to marry him," she thought dismally. She gave her standard answer. "I don't need a husband. My brother is trouble enough." "But you need love," he said. She groaned inwardly. She was about to reply when he held up a hand to stop her, a masculine habit she found particularly maddening. "Don't tell me you don't need love," he said. "Everybody needs love." She gazed at him steadily. She knew there was something peculiar about her. Most women were keen to get married, and if they were still single as she was at the age of 22, they were more than keen. They were desperate. "What's wrong with me?" she thought. Alfred was young, fit, and prosperous. Half the girls in Kingsbridge would like to marry him. For a moment, she toyed with the idea of saying yes, but the thought of actually living with Alfred, eating supper with him every night and going to church with him and giving birth to his children, was appalling. She would rather be lonely. She shook her head. "Forget it, Alfred," she said firmly. "I don't need a husband for love or anything else." He was not to be discouraged. "I love you, Aliena," he said. "Working with you, I've been truly happy. I need you. Will you be my wife?" He had said it now. She was sorry, for it meant she had to reject him formally. She had learned that there was no point in trying to do this gently, either. They took a kindly refusal as a sign of indecision, and pressed her all the more. "No, I won't," she said. "I don't love you, and I haven't much enjoyed working with you, and I wouldn't marry you if you were the only man on earth." He was hurt. He must have thought his chances were strong. Aliena was sure she had done nothing to encourage him. She had treated him as an equal partner, listened to him when he spoke, talked to him frankly and directly, fulfilled her responsibilities, and expected him to fulfill his. But some men took that for encouragement. "How can you say that?" he spluttered. She sighed. He was wounded, and she felt sorry for him, but in a moment he would be indignant and act as if she had made an unfair accusation against him. Then finally he would convince himself that she had gratuitously insulted him, and he would become offensive. Not all rejected suitors behaved like that, but a certain type did, and Alfred was that type. She was going to have to leave. She stood up. I respect your proposal, and I thank you for the honour you do me, she said. Please respect my refusal, and don't ask me again. I suppose you're running off to see my snot-nosed little step-brother, he said nastily. I can't imagine he gives you much of a ride. Alina flushed with embarrassment. So people were beginning to notice her friendship with Jack. Trust Alfred to put a smutty interpretation on it. Well, she was running off to see Jack, and she was not going to let Alfred stop her. She bent down and thrust her face into his. He was startled. Quietly and deliberately she said, "Go to hell." Then she turned and went out. Prior Philip held court in the crypt once a month. In the old days it had been once a year, and even then the business rarely took all day. But when the population trebled, law-breaking had increased tenfold. The nature of crime had changed, too. Formerly, most offences had to do with land, crops, or livestock. A greedy peasant would try surreptitiously to move the boundary of a field, so as to extend his land at the expense of a neighbour. A labourer would steal a sack of corn from the widow he worked for. A poor woman with too many children would milk a cow that was not hers. Nowadays, most of the cases involved money, Philip thought, as he sat through his court on the first day of December. Apprentices stole money from their masters. A husband took his wife's mother's savings. Merchants passed dud coinage, and wealthy women underpaid simple-minded servants who could hardly count their weekly wages. There had been no such crimes in Kingsbridge 5 years ago, because then nobody had much cash. Philip dealt with nearly all offences by a fine. He could also have people flogged or put in the stocks or imprisoned in the cell beneath the monk's dormitory, but these punishments were rarer and reserved mainly for crimes of violence. He had the right to hang thieves, and the priory owned a stout wooden gallows, but he had never used it, not yet, and he cherished a secret hope that he never would. The most serious crimes, murder, killing the king's deer, and highway robbery, were dealt with by the king's court at Shiring, presided over by the sheriff, and Sheriff Eustace did more than enough hanging. Today Philip had 7 cases of unauthorized grain grinding. He left them until the end and dealt with them all together. The priory had just built a new water mill to run alongside the old one. Kingsbridge needed 2 mills now. But the new building had to be paid for, which meant that everyone had to bring their grain to be ground at the priory. Strictly speaking, that had always been the law, as it was in every manor in the country. Peasants were not allowed to grind grain at home. They had to pay the lord to do it for them. In recent years, as the town grew and the old mill began to break down frequently, Philip had overlooked a growing amount of illicit grinding, but now he had to clamp down. He had the names of the offenders scratched on a slate, and he read them out one by one, beginning with the wealthiest. "Richard Longacre, you had a large grindstone turned by 2 men, Brother Franciscus says." Franciscus was the priory's miller. A prosperous-looking yeoman stepped forward. "Yes, my lord prior, but I've broken it now." "Pay 60 pence. Enid Brewster, you had a handmill in your brewery. Eric Enidson was seen using it, and he is charged 2.
"Yes, lord," said Enid, a red-faced woman with powerful shoulders.
"And where is the handmill now?" Philip asked her.
"I threw it in the river, lord."
Philip did not believe her, but there was not much he could do about it. "Find 24 pence and 12 for your son, Walter Tanner." Philip went on down the list, fining people according to the scale of their illegitimate operations, until he came to the last and poorest. "Widow Goda?" A pinch-faced old woman in faded black clothes stepped forward. "Brother Franciscus saw you grinding grain with a stone."
"I didn't have a penny for the mill, lord," she said resentfully.
"You had a penny to buy grain, though," Philip said. "You shall be punished like everyone else."
"Would you have me starve?" she said defiantly.
Philip sighed. He wished Brother Franciscus had pretended not to notice Goda breaking the law. "When was the last time someone starved to death in Kingsbridge?" he said. He looked around at the assembled citizens. "Anybody remember the last time someone starved to death in our town?" He paused for a moment as if waiting for a reply, then said, "I think you'll find it was before my time." Goda said, "Dick Shorthouse died last winter." Philip remembered the man, a beggar who slept in pigsties and stables. "Dick fell down drunk in the street at midnight and froze to death when it snowed," he said. "He didn't starve, and if he'd been sober enough to walk to the Priory, he wouldn't have been cold either. If you're hungry, don't try to cheat me. Come to me for charity, and if you're too proud to do that, and you would rather break the law instead, you must take your punishment like everyone else. Do you hear me?"
"Yes, Lord,"
the old woman said sulkily. "Find a farthing," Philip said. "Court is over." He stood up and went out, climbing the stairs that led up to ground level from the crypt. Work on the new cathedral had slowed dramatically, as it always did a month or so before Christmas. The exposed edges and tops of the unfinished stonework were covered with straw and dung, the litter from the priory stables, to keep the frost off the new masonry. The masons could not build in the winter because of the frost, they said. Philip had asked why they could not uncover the walls every morning and cover them again at night. It was not often frosty in the daytime. Tom said that walls built in winter fell down. Philip believed that, but he did not think it was because of the frost. He thought the real reason might be that the mortar took several months to set properly. The winter break allowed it to get really hard before the New Year's masonry was built on top. That would also explain the mason's superstition that it was bad luck to build more than 20 feet high in a single year. More than that, and the lower courses might become deformed by the weight on them before the mortar could harden. Philip was surprised to see all the masons out in the open, in what would be the chancel of the church. He went to see what they were doing. They had made a semicircular wooden arch and stood it upright, propped up with poles on both sides. Philip knew that the wooden arch was a piece of what they called falsework. Its purpose was to support the stone arch while it was being built. Now, however, the masons were assembling the stone arch at ground level, without mortar, to make sure the stones fit together perfectly. Apprentices and labourers were lifting the stones onto the falsework, while the masons looked on critically. Philip caught Tom's eye and said, "What's this for?" "It's an arch for the Tribune Gallery." Philip looked up reflexively. The arcade had been finished last year, and the gallery above it would be completed next year. Then only the top level, the clerestory, would remain to be built before the roof went on. Now that the walls had been covered up for the winter, the masons were cutting the stones ready for next year's work. If this arch was right, the stones for all the others would be cut to the same patterns. The apprentices, among whom was Tom's stepson, Jack, built the arch up from either side, with the wedge-shaped stones called voussoirs. Although the arch would eventually be built high up in the church, it would have elaborate decorative mouldings, so each stone bore on the surface that would be visible a line of large dog-tooth carving, another line of small medallions, and a bottom line of simple roll moulding. When the stones were put together, the carvings lined up exactly, forming three continuous arcs, one of dog-tooth, one of medallions, and one of roll moulding. This gave the impression that the arch was constructed of several semicircular hoops of stone, one on top of another, whereas in fact it was made of wedges placed side by side. However, the stones had to fit together precisely, otherwise the carvings would not line up and the illusion would be spoiled. Philip watched while Jack lowered the central keystone into place. Now the arch was complete. Four masons picked up sledgehammers and knocked out the wedges that supported the wooden falsework a few inches above the ground. Dramatically, the wooden support fell. Although there was no mortar between the stones, the arch remained standing. Tom Builder gave a grunt of satisfaction. Someone pulled at Philip's sleeve. He turned to see a young monk.
"You've got a visitor, Father. He's waiting in your house."
"Thank you, my son." Philip left the builders. If the monks had put the visitor in the prior's house to wait, that meant it was someone important. He crossed the close and went into his house. The visitor was his brother, Francis. Philip embraced him warmly. Francis looked careworn.
"Have you been offered something to eat?" Philip said. "You seem weary."
"They gave me some bread and meat, thanks.
I've spent the autumn riding between Bristol, where King Stephen was imprisoned, and Rochester, where Earl Robert was held.
You said was.
Francis nodded. I've been negotiating a swap, Stephen for Robert. It was done on All Saints' Day. King Stephen is now back in Winchester.
Philip was surprised. It seems to me that the Empress Maud got the worst of the bargain. She gave a king to get an earl.
Francis shook his head. She was helpless without Robert. Nobody likes her, nobody trusts her. Her support was collapsing. She had to have him back. Queen Matilda was clever. She wouldn't take anything less than King Stephen in exchange. She held out for that, and in the end she got it.
Philip went to the window and looked out. It had started to rain, a cold, slantwise rain, blowing across the building site, darkening the high walls of the cathedral and dripping off the low thatched roofs of the craftsmen's lodges.
What does it mean? He said.
It means that Maud is once again just an aspirant to the throne. After all, Stephen has actually been crowned, whereas Maud never was, not quite.
But it was Maud who licensed my market.
Yes, that could be a problem.
Is my license invalid?
No. It was properly granted by a legitimate ruler who had been approved by the church. The fact that she wasn't crowned doesn't make any difference, but Stephen could withdraw it.
The market is paying for the stone, Philip said anxiously. I can't build without it. This is bad news indeed.
I'm sorry.
What about my £100?
Francis shrugged. Stephen will tell you to get it back from Maud.
Philip felt sick. All that money. He said, it was God's money, and I lost it.
You haven't lost it yet, Francis said. Stephen may not revoke your license. He's never shown much interest in markets, one way or the other.
Earl William may pressure him.
William changed allegiance, remember? He threw his lot in with Maud. He won't have much influence with Stephen any more.
I hope you're right, Philip said fervently. I hope to God you're right.
When it got too cold to sit in the glade, Aliena took to visiting Tom Builder's house in the evenings. Alfred was normally at the alehouse, so the family group consisted of Tom, Ellen, Jack, and Martha. Now that Tom was doing so well, they had comfortable seats and a roaring fire and plenty of candles. Ellen and Aliena would work at the weaving. Tom would draw plans and diagrams, scratching his drawings with a sharp stone onto polished pieces of slate. Jack would pretend to be making a belt, or sharpening knives, or weaving a basket, although he would spend most of the time furtively staring at Aliena's face in the candlelight, watching her lips move as she talked, or studying her white throat as she drank a glass of ale. They laughed a lot that winter. Jack loved to make Aliena laugh. She was so controlled and reserved in general that it was a joy to see her let herself go, almost like catching a glimpse of her naked. He was constantly thinking of things to say to amuse her. He would do impressions of the craftsman on the building site, imitating the accent of a Parisian mason or the bow-legged walk of a blacksmith. Once he invented a comical account of life with the monks, giving each of them plausible sins, pride for Remigius, gluttony for Bernard Kitchener, drunkenness for the guest master, and lust for Pierre Circuiter. Martha was often helpless with laughter, and even the taciturn Tom cracked a smile. It was on one such evening that Aliena said, "I don't know if I'm going to be able to sell all this cloth." They were somewhat taken aback. Ellen said, "Then why are we weaving it?"
"I haven't given up hope," Aliena said. "I've just got a problem."
Tom looked up from his slate. "I thought the Priory was eager to buy it all."
"That's not the problem. I can't find people to do the felting, and the Priory doesn't want loose-woven cloth, nor does anyone else."
Ellen said, "Felting is back-breaking work. I'm not surprised no one will do it."
"Can't you get men to do it?" Tom suggested.
"Not in prosperous Kingsbridge. All the men have work enough. In the big towns there are professional fullers, but most of them work for weavers, and they're prohibited from felting for their employers' rivals. Anyway, it would cost too much to cart the cloth to Winchester and back."
"It's a real problem," Tom acknowledged, and went back to his drawing. Jack was struck by a thought. It's a pity we can't get oxen to do it. The others laughed. Tom said, you might as well try to teach an ox to build churches.
Or a mill, Jack persisted. There are usually easy ways to do the hardest work.
She wants to felt the cloth, not grind it, Tom said. Jack was not listening.
We use lifting gear and winding wheels to raise stones up to the high scaffolding.
Aliena said, oh, if there was some ingenious mechanism to get this cloth felted, it would be wonderful.
Jack thought how pleased she would be if he could solve this problem for her. He determined to find a way.
Tom said thoughtfully, I've heard of a watermill being used to work the bellows in a forge, but I've never seen it.
Really? Jack said. That proves it.
Tom said, a mill wheel goes round and round, and a grindstone goes round and round, so the one can drive the other, but a fuller's bat goes up and down. You can't make a round water wheel drive an up and down bat.
But a bellows goes up and down.
True, true. But I never saw that forge, I only heard tell of it. Jack tried to picture the machinery of a mill. The force of the water drove the mill wheel around. The shaft of the mill wheel was connected to another wheel inside the mill. The inside wheel, which was upright, had teeth that interlocked with the teeth of another wheel which lay flat. The flat wheel turned the millstone. An upright wheel can drive a flat wheel, Jack muttered, thinking aloud. Martha laughed.
Jack, stop! If mills could felt cloth, clever people would have thought of it already.
Jack ignored her. The fuller's bats could be fixed to the shaft of the mill wheel, he said. The cloth could be laid flat where the bats fall. Tom said, but the bats would strike once, then get stuck, and the wheel would stop. I told you, wheels go round and round, but bats have to go up and down.
There must be a way, Jack said stubbornly.
There's no way, Tom said decisively, in the tone of voice he used to close a conversational subject.
I bet there is, though,
Jack muttered rebelliously, and Tom pretended not to hear. On the following Sunday, Jack disappeared. He went to church in the morning and ate his dinner at home, as usual, but he did not appear at supper time. Aliena was in her own kitchen, making a thick broth of ham and cabbage with pepper in it, when Ellen came looking for Jack.
I haven't seen him since Mass, Aliena said.
He vanished after dinner, Ellen said. I assumed he was with you.
Aliena felt a little embarrassed that Ellen should have made that assumption so readily.
Are you worried?
Ellen shrugged. A mother is always worried.
Has he quarrelled with Alfred? Aliena said nervously.
I asked the same question. Alfred says not. Ellen sighed. I don't suppose he's come to any harm. He's done this before, and I dare say he'll do it again. I never taught him to keep regular hours.
Later in the evening, just before bedtime, Aliena called at Tom's house to see whether Jack had reappeared. He had not. She went to bed worried. Richard was away in Winchester, so she was alone. She kept thinking Jack might have fallen into the river and drowned, or something. How terrible that would be for Ellen. Jack was her only son. Tears came to Aliena's eyes when she imagined Ellen's grief at losing Jack.
This is stupid, she thought. I'm crying over someone else's sorrow, about something that hasn't happened.
She pulled herself together and tried to think of another subject. The surplus cloth was her big problem. Normally she would worry about business half the night, but tonight her mind kept returning to Jack. Suppose he had broken his leg and was lying in the forest unable to move.
Eventually she drifted into a restless sleep. She woke at first light, still feeling tired. She threw on her heavy cloak over her nightshirt and pulled on her fur-lined boots, then went outside to look for him. He was not in the garden behind the alehouse, where men commonly fell asleep, and were saved from freezing by the heat of the fetid dunghill. She went down to the bridge and walked fearfully along the bank to a bend in the river where debris was washed up. A family of ducks was scavenging among the bits of wood, worn-out shoes, rusty, discarded knives, and rotting meat bones on the beach. Jack was not there, thank God. She went back up the hill and into the priory close where the cathedral builders were beginning their day's work. She found Tom in his shed.
Has Jack come back?
She said hopefully.
Tom shook his head.
Not yet.
As she was going out, the master carpenter came up, looking worried.
"All our hammers have gone," he said to Tom.
"That's funny," Tom said.
"I've been looking for a hammer and can't find one."
Then Alfred put his head around the door and said, "Where are all the mason's bolsters?" Tom scratched his head. "It seems as if every hammer on the site has disappeared," he said in a baffled voice. Then his expression changed, and he said, "That boy Jack is behind this, I'll bet." "Of course," Aliena thought. "Hammers. Felting. The mill." Without saying what she was thinking, she left Tom's shed and hurried across the Priory Close, going past the kitchen to the southwest corner, where a channel diverted from the river drove two mills, one old and the other brand new. As she had suspected, the wheel of the old mill was turning. She went inside. What she saw confused and frightened her at first. There was a row of hammers fixed to a horizontal pole. Apparently of their own volition, the hammers lifted their heads like horses looking up from the manger. Then they went down again, all together, and struck simultaneously with a mighty bang that made her heart stop. She gave a cry of shock. The hammers lifted their heads as if they had heard her cry. Then they struck again. They were pounding a length of her loose-woven cloth that lay in an inch or two of water, in a shallow wooden trough of the type used by mortar-makers on the building site. The hammers were felting the cloth, she realized, and she stopped being frightened, although they still looked disturbingly alive. But how was it done? She saw that the pole on which the hammers were fixed ran parallel with the shaft of the mill-wheel. A plank fixed to the shaft went round and round as the shaft turned. When the plank came around, it connected with the handles of the hammers, pushing the handles down so that the heads came up. As the plank continued to turn, the handles were released. Then the hammers fell and pounded the cloth in the trough. It was exactly what Jack had talked about that evening, a mill that could felt cloth. She heard his voice. "The hammers should be weighted so that they fall harder." She turned around and saw him, looking tired but triumphant. "I think I've solved your problem," he said, and grinned sheepishly.
"I'm so glad you're all right. We were worried about you," she said.
Without thinking, she threw her arms around him and kissed him. It was a very brief kiss, not much more than a peck, but then when their lips separated, his arms went around her waist, holding her body gently but firmly against his own, and she found herself looking into his eyes. All she could think of was how happy she was that he was alive and unhurt. She gave him an affectionate squeeze. She was suddenly aware of her own skin. She could feel the roughness of her linen undershirt, and the soft fur of her boots, and her nipples tingled as they pressed against his chest.
"You were worried about me," he said wonderingly.
"Of course. I hardly slept."
She was smiling happily, but he looked terribly solemn, and after a moment his mood overcame hers, and she felt strangely moved. She could hear her heart beating and her breath came faster. Behind her, the hammers thudded in unison, shaking the wooden structure of the mill with each concerted blow, and she seemed to feel the vibration deep inside her.
"I'm all right," he said. "Everything's all right."
"I'm so glad," she repeated,
and it came out in a whisper. She saw him close his eyes and bend his face to hers, and then she felt his mouth on her own. His kiss was gentle. He had full lips and a soft, adolescent beard. She closed her eyes to concentrate on the sensation. His mouth moved against hers, and it seemed natural to part her lips. Her mouth had suddenly become ultra-sensitive, so that she could feel the lightest touch, the tiniest movement. The tip of his tongue caressed the inside of her upper lip. She felt so overwhelmed with happiness that she wanted to cry. She pressed her body against his, crushing her soft breasts against his hard chest, feeling the bones of his hips dig into her belly. She was no longer merely relieved that he was safe and glad to have him here. Now there was a new emotion. His physical presence filled her with an ecstatic sensation that made her slightly dizzy. Holding his body in her arms, she wanted to touch him more, to feel more of him, to get even closer. She rubbed his back with her hands. She wanted to feel his skin, but his clothes frustrated her. Without thinking, she opened her mouth and pushed her tongue between his lips. He made a small animal sound in the back of his throat, like a muffled moan of delight. The door of the mill banged open. Aliena pulled away from Jack. Suddenly, she felt shocked, as if she had been fast asleep and someone had slapped her to wake her up. She was horrified by what they had been doing, kissing and rubbing one another like a whore and a drunk in an alehouse. She stepped back and turned around, mortified with embarrassment. The intruder was Alfred, of all people. That made her feel worse. Alfred had proposed marriage to her 3 months ago, and she had refused him haughtily. Now he had seen her acting like a bitch in heat. It seemed somehow hypocritical. She flushed with shame. Alfred was staring at her, his expression a mixture of lust and contempt that reminded her vividly of William Hamley. She was disgusted with herself for giving Alfred a reason to look down on her, and furious at Jack for his part in it. She turned away from Alfred and looked at Jack. When his eyes met hers, he registered shock. She realized that her anger was showing in her face, but she could not help it. Jack's expression of dazed happiness turned into confusion and hurt. Normally that would have melted her, but now she was too upset. She hated him for what he had made her do. Quick as a flash, she slapped his face. He did not move, but there was agony in his look. His cheek reddened where she had hit him. She could not bear to see the pain in his eyes. She tore her gaze away. She could not stay there. She ran to the door with the incessant thud of the hammers pounding in her ears. Alfred stepped aside quickly, looking almost frightened. She dashed past him and went through the door. Tom Builder was just outside with a small crowd of building workers. Everyone was heading for the mill to find out what was going on. Aliena hurried past them without speaking. One or two of them glanced curiously at her, making her burn with shame. But they were more interested in the hammering sound coming from the mill. The coldly logical part of Aliena's mind recalled that Jack had solved the problem of felting her cloth. But the thought that he had been up all night doing something for her only made her feel worse. She ran past the stable, through the priory gate, and along the street, her boots slipping and sliding in the mud until she reached her house. When she got inside, she found Richard there. He was sitting at the kitchen table with a loaf of bread and a bowl of ale. "King Stephen is on the march," he said. "The war has started again. I need a new horse." 4. For the next 3 months, Aliena hardly spoke two words in a row to Jack. He was heartbroken. She had kissed him as if she loved him. There was no mistaking that. When she left the mill, he felt sure they would kiss like that again soon. He walked around in an erotic haze, thinking, "Aliena loves me! Aliena loves me!" She had stroked his back and put her tongue into his mouth and pressed her breasts against him. When she avoided him, he thought at first that she was just embarrassed. She could not possibly pretend not to love him after that kiss. He waited for her to get over her shyness. With the help of the priory carpenter, he made a stronger, more permanent fulling mechanism for the old mill, and Aliena got her cloth felted. She thanked him sincerely, but her voice was cold and her eyes evaded his. When it had gone on not just for a few days, but for several weeks, he was forced to admit that there was something seriously wrong. A tidal wave of disillusionment engulfed him, and he felt as if he would drown in regret. He was baffled. He wished miserably that he was older and had more experience with women, so that he could tell whether she was normal or peculiar, whether this was temporary or permanent, and whether he should ignore it or confront her. Being uncertain and also being terrified of saying the wrong thing and making matters worse, he did nothing. And then the constant feeling of rejection began to get to him, and he felt worthless, stupid, and impotent. He thought how foolish he was to have imagined that the most desirable and unattainable woman in the county might fall for him, a mere boy. He had amused her for a while, with his stories and his jokes, but as soon as he had kissed her like a man, she had run away. What a fool he was to have hoped for anything else. After a week or two of telling himself how stupid he was, he began to get angry. He was irritable at work, and people started to treat him warily. He was mean to his stepsister Martha, who was almost as hurt by him as he was by Aliena. On Sunday afternoons, he wasted his wages gambling on cockfights. All his passion came out in his work. He was carving corbels, the jutting-out stones that appeared to support arches or shafts that did not reach all the way to the ground. Corbels were often decorated with leaves, but a traditional alternative was to carve a man who appeared to be holding up the arch with his hands, or supporting it on his back. Jack altered the customary pattern just a little, but the effect was to show a disturbingly twisted human figure with an expression of pain, condemned, as it were, to an eternity of agony as he held up the vast weight of stone. Jack knew it was brilliant. Nobody else could carve a figure that looked as if it were in pain. When Tom saw it, he shook his head, unsure whether to marvel at its expressiveness or disapprove of its unorthodoxy. Philip was very taken with it. Jack did not care what they thought. He felt that anyone who disliked it was blind. One Monday in Lent, when everyone was short-tempered because they had not eaten meat for 3 weeks, Alfred came to work with a triumphant look on his face. He had been to Shiring the day before. Jack did not know what he had done there, but he was clearly pleased about it. During the mid-morning break, when Enid Brewster tapped a barrel of ale in the middle of the chancel and sold it to the builders, Alfred held out a penny and called, "Hey, Jack Thompson, fetch me some ale." "This is going to be about my father," Jack thought. He ignored Alfred. One of the carpenters, an older man called Peter, said, "You'd better do what you're told, prentice boy." An apprentice was always supposed to obey a master craftsman. "I'm not Tom's son," Jack said. "Tom is my stepfather, and Alfred knows it." "Do what he says all the same," Peter said in a reasonable tone. Reluctantly, Jack took Alfred's money and joined the line. "My father's name was Jack Sherberg," he said in a loud voice. "You can all call me Jack Jackson, if you want to make a difference between me and Jack Blacksmith." Alfred said, "Jack Bastard is more like it." Jack said to the world at large, "Have you ever wondered why Alfred never laces up his boots?" They all looked at Alfred's feet. Sure enough, his heavy muddy boots, which were designed to be tied at the top with cords, were loosely open. "It's so that he can get at his toes quickly, in case he needs to count above 10. The craftsman smiled, and the apprentices chortled. Jack handed Alfred's penny to Enid and got a jug of ale. He took it to Alfred and handed it to him with a small, satirical bow. Alfred was annoyed, but not very. He still had something up his sleeve. Jack moved away and drank his ale with the apprentices, hoping Alfred would lay off. It was not to be. A few moments later, Alfred followed him and said, "If Jack Sherberg was my father, I wouldn't be so quick to claim him. Don't you realize what he was?" "He was a jongleur," Jack said. He made himself sound confident, but he was afraid of what Alfred was going to say. "I don't suppose you know what a jongleur is." "He was a thief," said Alfred. "Oh, shut up, shithead." Jack turned away and sipped his beer, but he could hardly swallow. Alfred had a reason for saying this. "Don't you know how he died?" Alfred persisted. "This is it," Jack thought. "This is what he learned yesterday in Shiring. This is why he's wearing that stupid grin." He turned around reluctantly and faced Alfred. "No, I don't know how my father died, Alfred, but I think you're going to tell me." "He was hanged by the neck like the lousy thief he was." Jack gave an involuntary cry of anguish. He knew intuitively that this was true. Alfred was so completely sure of himself that he could not be making it up. And Jack saw in a flash that this explained his mother's reticence. For years, he had secretly dreaded something like this. All the time he had pretended there was nothing wrong, he was not a bastard, he had a real father with a real name. In fact, he had always feared that there was a disgrace about his father, that the taunts were valid, that he really did have something to be ashamed of. He was already low, Aliena's rejection had left him feeling worthless and small. Now the truth about his father hit him like a blow. Alfred stood there smiling, inordinately pleased with himself. The effect of his revelation had delighted him. His expression maddened Jack. It was bad enough for Jack that his father had been hanged. That Alfred was happy about it was too much to bear. Without thinking, Jack threw his beer in Alfred's grinning face. The other apprentices, who had been watching the two stepbrothers and enjoying the altercation, hastily moved a step or two back. Alfred dashed the beer from his eyes, roared with anger, and lashed out with one huge fist, a surprisingly quick movement for such a big man. The blow connected with Jack's cheek, so hard that instead of hurting, it just went numb. Before he had time to react, Alfred's other fist sank into his middle. This punch hurt terribly. Jack felt as if he would never breathe again. He crumpled and fell to the ground. As he landed, Alfred kicked him in the head with one heavy boot, and for a moment he saw nothing but white light. He rolled over blindly and struggled to his feet, but Alfred was not yet satisfied. As Jack came upright, he felt himself grabbed. He began to wriggle. He was frightened now. Alfred would have no mercy. Jack would be beaten to a pulp if he could not escape. For a moment, Alfred's grip was too strong and Jack could not get free, but then Alfred drew back one massive fist for a blow, and in that instant Jack slipped out of his grasp. He darted away and Alfred lunged after him. Jack dodged around a lime barrel, pulling it over so that it fell in Alfred's path, spilling lime on the ground. Alfred jumped over the barrel but cannoned into a water butt, and that too was upset. When the water came into contact with the lime, it boiled and hissed fiercely. Some of the builders, seeing the waste of costly material, shouted protests, but Alfred was deaf to them, and Jack could think of nothing but trying to get away from Alfred. He ran, still doubled up with pain and half blind from the kick in the head. Hard on his heels, Alfred stuck out a foot and tripped him. Jack fell headlong. "I'm going to die," he thought as he rolled over. "Alfred will kill me now." He fetched up under a ladder that was leaning against the scaffolding high up on the building. Alfred bore down on him. Jack felt like a cornered rabbit. The ladder saved him. As Alfred ducked behind it, Jack dodged around to the front and catapulted himself up the rungs. He went up the ladder like a rat up a gutter. He felt the ladder shake as Alfred came up behind him. Normally he could outrun Alfred, but he was still dazed and winded. He reached the top and lurched onto the scaffolding. He stumbled and fell against the wall. The stonework had been laid that morning and the mortar was still wet. As Jack careered into it, a whole section of the wall shifted and three or four stones slipped sideways and fell over the side. Jack thought he was going with them. He teetered at the edge, and as he looked down he saw the big stones tumbling over and over as they fell 80 feet and landed on the roofs of the lean-to lodges at the foot of the wall. He righted himself and hoped no one was in the lodges. Alfred came up over the top of the ladder and advanced toward him on the flimsy scaffolding. Alfred was red and panting, and his eyes were full of hate. Jack had no doubt that in this state Alfred could kill. "If he gets hold of me," Jack thought, "he'll throw me over the side." As Alfred advanced, Jack retreated. He trod in something soft and realized it was a pile of mortar. Inspired, he stooped quickly, picked up a handful, and threw it accurately into Alfred's eyes. Blinded, Alfred stopped advancing and shook his head, trying to get rid of the mortar. At last, Jack had a chance to escape. He ran to the far end of the scaffolding platform, intending to descend, run out of the priory close, and spend the rest of the day hiding in the forest. But to his horror, there was no ladder at the other end of the platform. He could not climb down the scaffolding, for it did not reach to the ground. It was built on joists stuck into putlog holes in the wall. He was trapped. He looked back. Alfred had got his eyesight back and was coming toward him. There was one other way down. At the unfinished end of the wall, where the chancel would join on to the transept, each course of masonry was half a stone's length shorter than the one below, creating a steep flight of narrow steps, which was sometimes used by the more daring laborers as an alternative way up to the platform. With his heart in his mouth, Jack got on top of the wall and walked along, carefully but quickly, trying not to see how far he would fall if he slipped. He reached the top of the stepped section, paused at the edge and looked down. He felt faintly sick. He glanced back over his shoulder. Alfred was on the wall behind him. He went down. Jack could not understand why Alfred was so unafraid. He had never been brave. It was as if hatred had dulled his sense of danger.